found slumped on doorsteps and on the streets. Bill was certain that they'd been poisoned. He and Rita found themselves in the grip of tense silence. He confided in a friend that he didn't expect to live very long. On March 9th, a day of swirling winds, Bill drove with a friend to the bootlegger Henry Grammer's ranch, which was on the western edge of the reservation. Bill told his friend that he needed a drink. But Bill knew that Grammer, whom the Osage chief called the county's most notorious character, possessed secrets and controlled an unseen world. The Roan investigation had produced one revelation. Before disappearing, Roan had said that he was going to get whiskey at Grammer's ranch, the same place, coincidentally or not, where Molly's sister Anna often got her whiskey, too. Grammer was a rodeo star who had performed at Madison Square Garden and been crowned the steer-roping champion of the world. He was also an alleged train robber, a kingpin bootlegger with connections to the Kansas City mob, and a blazing gunman. The porous legal system seemed unable to contain him. In 1904, in Montana, he gunned down a sheep shearer, yet he received only a 3-year sentence. In a later incident in Osage County, a man came into a hospital bleeding profusely from a gunshot wound, moaning, "I'm going to die. I'm going to die." He fingered Grammer as his shooter, then passed out. But when the victim woke up the next day and realized that he wasn't going to the Heavenly Lord, at least not any time soon, he insisted that he had no idea who had pulled the trigger. As Grammer's bootlegging empire grew, he held sway over an army of bandits. They included Asa Kirby, a stick-up man who had glimmering gold front teeth, and John Ramsey, a cow rustler who seemed the least bad of Grammer's bad men. Bill and his friend arrived at Grammer's ranch in the gathering dusk. A large wooden house and a barn loomed before them, and hidden in the surrounding woods were 500-gallon copper stills. Grammer had set up his own private power plant so that his gangs could work all day and all night. The furtive light of the moon no longer needed to manufacture moonshine. Finding that Grammer was away, Bill asked one of the workers for several jars of whiskey. He took a swig. In a nearby pasture, Grammer's prized horses often roamed. How easy it would have been for Bill, the old horse thief, to mount one and disappear. Bill drank some more. Then he and his friend drove back to Fairfax, passing the string of light bulbs, the frayed lights, as they were called, that shivered in the wind. Bill dropped his friend off, and when he got home, he pulled his Studebaker into the garage. Rita was in the house with Nettie Brookshire, a 19-year-old white servant who often stayed over. They soon went to bed. Just before 3 in the morning, a man who lived nearby heard a loud explosion. The force of the blast radiated through the neighborhood, bending trees and signposts and blowing out windows. In a Fairfax hotel, a night watchman sitting by a window was showered with broken glass and thrown to the floor. In another room of the hotel, a guest was hurled backward. Closer to the blast, doors on houses were smashed and torn asunder. Wooden beams cracked like bones. A witness who had been a boy at the time later wrote, "It seemed that the night would never stop trembling." Molly and Ernest felt the explosion, too. "It shook everything," Ernest later recalled. "At first, I thought it was thunder." Molly, frightened, got up and went to the window and could see something burning in the distant sky, as if the sun had burst violently into the night. Ernest went to the window and stood there with her, the two of them looking out at the eerie glow. Ernest slipped on his trousers and ran outside. People were stumbling from their houses, groggy and terrified, carrying lanterns and firing guns in the air, a warning signal and a call for others to join what was a growing procession, a rush of people moving on foot and in cars toward the site of the blast. As people got closer, they cried out, "It's Bill Smith's house! It's Bill Smith's house!" Only there was no longer a house. Nothing but heaps of charred sticks and twisted metal and shredded furniture, which Bill and Rita had purchased just days earlier from the Big Hill Trading Company, and strips of bedding hanging from telephone wires and pulverized debris floating through the black, toxic air. Even the Studebaker had been demolished. A witness struggled for words. It just looked like, I don't know what. Clearly, someone had planted a bomb under the house and detonated it. The flames amid the rubble consumed the remaining fragments of the house and gusted into the sky, a nimbus of fire. Volunteer firemen were carrying water from wells and trying to put out the blaze. And people were looking for Bill and Rita and Nettie.
"Come on, men. There's a woman in there," one rescuer cried out.
The Justice of the Peace had joined the search, and so had Mathis and the Schoen brothers. Even before remains were found, the Big Hill Trading Company undertaker had arrived with his hearse. A rival undertaker showed up as well, the two hovering like predatory birds. The searchers scoured the ruins. James Schoen, having once owned the house, knew where the main bedroom had been situated. He combed in the vicinity, and that's when he heard a voice calling out. Others could hear it too, faint but distinct.
"Help! Help!"
A searcher pointed to a smoldering mound above the voice. Firemen doused the area with water, and amid the steaming smoke, everyone began clawing the rubble away. As they worked, the voice grew louder, rising over the sound of the heaving, creaking wreckage. Finally, a face began to take shape, blackened and tormented. It was Bill Smith. He was writhing by his bed. His legs were seared beyond recognition. So were his back and hands. David Schoen later recalled that, in all his years as a doctor, he'd never seen a man in such agony. He was hallowing and was in awful misery. James Schoen tried to comfort Bill, telling him, "I won't let you suffer." As the group of men cleared the debris, they could see that Rita was lying beside him in her nightgown. Her face was unmarred, and she looked as if she were still peacefully sleeping in a dream. But when they lifted her up, they saw that the back of her head was crushed. She had no more life in her. When Bill realized that she was dead, he let out a torturous cry.
"Rita's gone," he repeated.
He told a friend who was there,
"If you've got a pistol."
Ernest, wearing a bathrobe that someone had handed him to cover himself, was looking on. He was unable to turn away from the horror, and he kept muttering,
"Some fire."
The Big Hill undertaker asked him for permission to remove Rita's remains, and Ernest consented.
Someone had to embalm her before Molly saw her. What would she say when she learned that another sister had been murdered? Now Molly, once expected to die first because of her diabetes, was the only one left. The searchers couldn't find Nettie. The justice of the peace determined that the young woman, who was married and had a child, had been blown to pieces. There weren't even sufficient remains for an inquest, though the rival undertaker found enough to claim the fee for a burial.
I figured on getting back and getting the hired girl with the hearse, but he beat me, the Big Hill undertaker said.
The doctors and the others lifted Bill Smith up as he grabbed for breath. They carried him toward an ambulance and took him to the Fairfax Hospital, where David Schoen injected him multiple times with morphine. He was the lone survivor, but before he could be questioned, he lost consciousness. It had taken a while for local lawmen to arrive at the hospital. The town marshal and other officers had been in Oklahoma City for a court case. The time of the deed was also deliberate, an investigator later noted, because it was done when officers were all away. After hearing the news and rushing back to Fairfax, lawmen set up floodlights at the front and rear exits of the hospital in case the killers planned to finish off Bill there. Armed guards kept watch, too. In a state of delirium, wavering between life and death, Bill would sometimes mutter, "They got Rita, and now it looks like they've got me." The friend who had accompanied him to Grammer's ranch came to see him.
"He just kind of jabbered," the friend recalled. "I couldn't understand anything he said."
After nearly 2 days, Bill regained consciousness. He asked about Rita. He wanted to know where she was buried. David Schoen said he thought that Bill, fearing he might die, was about to make a declaration, to reveal what he knew about the bombing and the killers.
"I tried to get it out of him," the doctor later told authorities. "I said, 'Bill, have you any idea who did it? I was anxious to know.'"
But the doctor said Bill never did disclose anything relevant. On March 14th, 4 days after the bombing, Bill Smith died. Another victim of what had become known as the Osage Reign of Terror. A Fairfax newspaper published an editorial arguing that the bombing was beyond comprehension, beyond our power to realize that humans would stoop so low. The paper demanded that the law leave no stone unturned to ferret out the perpetrators and bring them to justice. A firefighter at the scene had told Ernest that those responsible for this should be thrown in the fire and burned. In April 1923, Governor Jack C. Walton of Oklahoma dispatched his top state investigator, Herman Fox Davis, to Osage County. A lawyer and a former private detective with the Burns Agency, Davis had a groomed sleekness. He puffed on cigars, his eyes shining through a veil of blue smoke. A law enforcement official called him the epitome of a dime novel detective. Many Osage had come to believe that local authorities were colluding with the killers, and that only an outside force like Davis could cut through the corruption and solve the growing number of cases. Yet within days, Davis was spotted consorting with some of the county's notorious criminals. Another investigator then caught Davis taking a bribe from the head of a local gambling syndicate in exchange for letting him operate his illicit businesses. And it soon became clear
that the state's special investigator in charge of solving the Osage murder cases was himself a crook. In June 1923, Davis pleaded guilty to bribery and received a 2-year sentence. But a few months later, he was pardoned by the governor. Then Davis and several conspirators proceeded to rob and murder a prominent attorney. This time, Davis received a life sentence. In November, Governor Walton was impeached and removed from office, partly for having abused the system of pardons and paroles, and having turned loose upon the honest citizens of the state a horde of murderers and criminals, and partly for having received illicit contributions from the oil man E. W. Marland that were used to build a lavish home. Amid this garish corruption, W. W. Vaughn, a 54-year-old attorney who lived in Pawhuska, tried to act with decency. A former prosecutor who vowed to eliminate the criminal element that was a parasite upon those who make their living by honest means, he had worked closely with the private investigators struggling to solve the Osage murder cases. One day in June 1923, Vaughn received an urgent call. It was from a friend of George Bighart, who was a nephew of the legendary chief James Bighart. Suffering from suspected poisoning, Bighart, who was 46 and who had once written on a school application that he hoped to help the needy, feed the hungry, and clothe the naked, had been rushed to a hospital in Oklahoma City. His friend said that he had information about the murders of the Osage, but would speak only to Vaughn, whom he trusted. When Vaughn asked about Bighart's condition, he was told to hurry. Before leaving, Vaughn informed his wife, who had recently given birth to their 10th child, about a hiding spot where he had stashed evidence that he had been gathering on the murders. If anything should happen to him, he said, she should take it out immediately and turn it over to the authorities. She would also find money there for her and the children. When Vaughn got to the hospital, Bighart was still conscious. There were others in the room, and Bighart motioned for them to leave. Bighart then apparently shared his information, including incriminating documents. Vaughn remained at Bighart's side for several hours until he was pronounced dead. Then Vaughn telephoned the new Osage County Sheriff to say that he had all the information he needed and that he was rushing back on the first train. The sheriff pressed him if he knew who had killed Bighart. "Oh, he knew more than that," Vaughn said. He hung up and went to the station where he was seen boarding an overnight train. When the train pulled into the station the next day, though, there was no sign of him. Owner vanishes, leaving clothes in Pullman car, the Tulsa Daily World reported. Mystery cloaks disappearance of W. W. Vaughn of Pawhuska. The Boy Scouts, whose first troop in the United States was organized in Pawhuska in 1909, joined the search for Vaughn. Bloodhounds hunted for his scent. 36 hours later, Vaughn's body was spotted lying by the railroad tracks 30 miles north of Oklahoma City. He'd been thrown from the train. His neck was broken, and he'd been stripped virtually naked, just like the oil man McBride. The documents Bighart had given him were gone, and when Vaughn's widow went to the designated hiding spot, it had been cleaned out. The justice of the peace was asked by a prosecutor if he thought that Vaughn had known too much. The justice replied, "Yes, sir," and had valuable papers on his person. The official death toll of the Osage Reign of Terror had climbed to at least 24 members of the tribe. Among the victims were two more men who had tried to assist the investigation. One, a prominent Osage rancher, plunged down a flight of stairs after being drugged. The other was gunned down in Oklahoma City on his way to brief state officials about the case. News of the murders began to spread. In an article titled The Black Curse of the Osages, the Literary Digest, a national publication, reported that members of the tribe had been shot in lonely pastures, bored by steel as they sat in their automobiles, poisoned to die slowly, and dynamited as they slept in their homes. The article went on. In the meantime, the curse goes on. Where it will end, no one knows. The world's richest people per capita were becoming the world's most murdered. The press later described the killings as being as dark and sordid as any murder story of the century and the bloodiest chapter in American crime history. All efforts to solve the mystery had faltered. Because of anonymous threats, the Justice of the Peace was forced to stop convening inquests into the latest murders. He was so terrified that merely to discuss the cases, he would retreat into a back room and bolt the door. The new county sheriff dropped even a pretense of investigating the crimes.
"I didn't want to get mixed up in it," he later admitted, adding cryptically, "There is an undercurrent like a spring at the head of the hollow. Now there is no spring. It is gone dry, but it is broke way down to the bottom."
Of solving the cases, he said,
"It is a big doings, and the sheriff and a few men couldn't do it. It takes the government to do it."
In 1923, after the Smith bombing, the Osage tribe began to urge the federal government to send investigators who, unlike the sheriff or Davis, had no ties to the county or to state officials. The tribal council adopted a formal resolution that stated, "Whereas in no case have the criminals been apprehended and brought to justice, and whereas the Osage Tribal Council deems it essential for the preservation of the lives and property of members of the tribe that prompt and strenuous action be taken to capture and punish the criminals, be it further resolved that the Honorable Secretary of the Interior be requested to obtain the services of the Department of Justice in capturing and prosecuting the murderers of the members of the Osage tribe." Later, John Palmer, the half-Sioux lawyer, sent a letter to Charles Curtis, a U.S. senator from Kansas. Part Kaw, part Osage, Curtis was then the highest official with acknowledged Indian ancestry ever elected to office. Palmer told Curtis that the situation was more dire than anyone could possibly imagine, and that unless he and other men of influence got the Department of Justice to act, the demons behind the most foul series of crimes ever committed in this country would escape justice. While the tribe waited for the federal government to respond, Molly lived in dread, knowing that she was likely the next target in the apparent plot to eliminate her family. She couldn't forget the night, several months before the explosion, when she had been in bed with Ernest and heard a noise outside her house. Someone was breaking into their car. Ernest comforted Molly, whispering, "Lie still," as the perpetrator roared away in the stolen vehicle. When the bombing occurred, Hale had been in Texas, and he now saw the charred detritus of the house, which resembled a wreckage of war.
A horrible monument, as one investigator called it. Hale promised Molly that somehow he'd avenge her family's blood. When Hale heard that a band of outlaws, perhaps the same band responsible for the Reign of Terror, was planning to rob a store owner who kept diamonds in a safe, he handled the matter himself. He alerted the shopkeeper, who lay in wait. Sure enough, that night, the shopkeeper saw the intruders breaking in and blew one of them away with his single-barreled 12-gauge shotgun. After the other outlaws fled, authorities went to inspect the dead man and saw his gold front teeth. It was Asa Kirby, Henry Grammer's associate. One day, Hale's pastures were set on fire, the blaze spreading for miles, the blackened earth strewn with the carcasses of cattle. To Molly, even the king of the Osage Hills seemed vulnerable, and after pursuing justice for so long, she retreated behind the closed doors and the shuttered windows of her house. She stopped entertaining guests or attending church. It was as if the murders had shattered even her faith in God. Among residents of the county, there were whispers that she'd locked herself away lest she go mad, or that her mind was already unraveling under the strain. Her diabetes also appeared to be worsening. The Office of Indian Affairs received a note from someone who knew Molly, saying that she was in failing health and is not expected to live very long. Consumed by fear and ill health, she gave her third child, Anna, to a relative to be raised. Time ground on. There are few records, at least authoritative ones, of Molly's existence during this period. No record of how she felt when agents from the Bureau of Investigation, an obscure branch of the Justice Department that in 1935 would be renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation, finally arrived in town. No record of what she thought of physicians like the Schoen brothers, who were constantly coming and going, injecting her with what was said to be a new miracle drug, insulin. It was as if, after being forced to play a tragic hand, she'd dealt herself out of history. Then, in late 1925, the local priest received a secret message from Molly. Her life, she said, was in danger. An agent from the Office of Indian Affairs soon picked up another report. Molly wasn't dying of diabetes at all. She, too, was being poisoned.
Chronicle 2. The Evidence Man. A conspiracy is everything that ordinary life is not. It's the inside game, cold, sure, undistracted, forever closed off to us. We are the flawed ones, the innocents, trying to make some rough sense of the daily jostle. Conspirators have a logic and a daring beyond our reach. All conspiracies are the same taut story of men who find coherence in some criminal act. Don DeLillo, Libra. 8. Department of Easy Virtue. One day in the summer of 1925, Tom White, the special agent in charge of the Bureau of Investigation's field office in Houston, received an urgent order from headquarters in Washington, D.C. The new boss man, J. Edgar Hoover, asked to speak to him right away, in person. White quickly packed. Hoover demanded that his staff wear dark suits and sober neckties and black shoes polished to a gloss. He wanted his agents to be a specific American type. Caucasian, lawyerly, professional. Every day he seemed to issue a new directive. A new thou shall not. and White put on his big cowboy hat with an air of defiance. He bade his wife and two young boys goodbye and boarded a train the way he had years earlier when he served as a railroad detective, riding from station to station in pursuit of criminals. Now he wasn't chasing anything but his own fate. When he arrived in the nation's capital, he made his way through the noise and lights to headquarters. He'd been told that Hoover had an important message for him, but he had no idea what it was. White was an old-style lawman. He had served in the Texas Rangers near the turn of the century, and he'd spent much of his life roaming on horseback across the southwestern frontier, a Winchester rifle or a pearl-handled six-shooter in hand, tracking fugitives and murderers and stick-up men. He was 6'4" and had the sinewy limbs and the eerie composure of a gunslinger. Even when dressed in a stiff suit like a door-to-door salesman, he seemed to have sprung from a mythic age. Years later, a bureau agent who had worked for White wrote that he was as God-fearing as the mighty defenders of the Alamo, adding, "He was an impressive sight in his large suede Stetson, and a plumb line running from head to heel would touch every part of the rear of his body. He had a majestic tread, as soft and silent as a cat. He talked like he looked and shot right on target. He commanded the utmost in respect and scared the daylights out of young Easterners like me who looked upon him with a mixed feeling of reverence and fear. Albeit, if one looked intently enough into his steel-gray eyes, he could see a kindly and understanding gleam." White had joined the Bureau of Investigation in 1917. He had wanted to enlist in the Army to fight in World War I, but he had been barred because of a recent surgery. Becoming a special agent was his way of serving his country, he said, but that was only part of it. Truth was, he knew that the tribe of old frontier lawmen to which he belonged was vanishing. Though he wasn't yet 40, he was in danger of becoming a relic in a Wild West traveling show, living but dead. President Theodore Roosevelt had created the Bureau in 1908, hoping to fill the void in federal law enforcement. Because of lingering opposition to a national police force, Roosevelt's attorney general had acted without legislative approval, leading one congressman to label the new organization a bureaucratic bastard. When White entered the Bureau, it still had only a few hundred agents and only a smattering of field officers. Its jurisdiction over crimes was limited, and agents handled a hodgepodge of cases. They investigated antitrust and banking violations, the interstate shipment of stolen cars, contraceptives, prize-fighting films and smutty books, escapes by federal prisoners, and crimes committed on Indian reservations. Like other agents, White was supposed to be strictly a fact-gatherer. "In those days we had no power of arrest," White later recalled. Agents were also not authorized to carry guns. White had seen plenty of lawmen killed on the frontier, and though he didn't talk much about these deaths, they had nearly caused him to abandon his calling. He didn't want to leave this world for some posthumous glory. Dead was dead. And so when he was on a dangerous bureau assignment, he sometimes tucked a six-shooter in his belt. To heck with the thou shall nots. His younger brother, J.C. Doc White, was also a former Texas Ranger who had joined the Bureau. A gruff, hard-drinking man who often carried a bone-handled six-shooter and for good measure a knife slipped into his leather boot, he was brasher than Tom, rough and ready, as a relative described him. The White brothers were part of a small contingent of frontier lawmen who were known inside the Bureau as the Cowboys. Tom White had no formal training as a law enforcement officer, and he struggled to master new scientific methods such as decoding the mystifying whorls and loops of fingerprints. Yet he had been upholding the law since he was a young man, and he had honed his skills as an investigator, the ability to discern underlying patterns and turn a scattering of facts into a taut narrative. Despite his sensitivity to danger, he had experienced wild gunfights, but unlike his brother Doc, who, as one agent said, had a bullet-spattered career, Tom had an almost perverse habit of not wanting to shoot, and he was proud of the fact that he'd never put anyone into the ground. It was as if he were afraid of his own dark instincts. There was a thin line, he felt, between a good man and a bad one. Tom White had witnessed many of his colleagues at the Bureau cross that line. During the Harding administration in the early 1920s, the Justice Department had been packed with political cronies and unscrupulous officials, among them the head of the Bureau, William Burns, the infamous Private Eye. After being appointed director in 1921, Burns had bent laws and hired crooked agents, including a confidence man who peddled protection and pardons to members of the underworld. The Department of Justice had become known as the Department of Easy Virtue. In 1924, after a congressional committee revealed that the oil baron, Harry Sinclair, had bribed the Secretary of the Interior, Albert Fall, to drill in the Teapot Dome Federal Petroleum Reserve, the name that would forever be associated with the scandal, the ensuing investigation lay bare just how rotten the system of justice was in the United States. When Congress began looking into the Justice Department, Burns and the Attorney General used all their power, all the tools of law enforcement, to thwart the inquiry and obstruct justice. Members of Congress were shadowed. Their offices were broken into and their phones tapped. One senator denounced the various illegal plots, counterplots, espionage, decoys, dictographs that were being used not to detect and prosecute crime, but to shield profiteers, bribe-takers, and favorites. By the summer of 1924, Harding's successor, Calvin Coolidge, had gotten rid of Burns and appointed a new attorney general, Harlan Fiske Stone. Given the growth of the country and the profusion of federal laws, Stone concluded that a national police force was indispensable, but in order to serve this need, the Bureau had to be transformed from top to bottom. To the surprise of many of the department's critics, Stone selected J. Edgar Hoover, the 29-year-old deputy director of the Bureau, to serve as acting director while he searched for a permanent replacement. Though Hoover had avoided the stain of Teapot Dome, he had overseen the Bureau's rogue intelligence division, which had spied on individuals merely because of their political beliefs. Hoover had also never been a detective. Never been in a shootout or made an arrest. His grandfather and his father, who were deceased, had worked for the federal government, and Hoover, who still lived with his mother, was a creature of the bureaucracy. Its gossip, its lingo, its unspoken deals, its bloodless but vicious territorial wars. Coveting the directorship as a way to build his own bureaucratic empire, Hoover concealed from Stone the extent of his role in domestic surveillance operations and promised to disband the intelligence division. He zealously implemented the reforms requested by Stone that furthered his own desire to remake the Bureau into a modern force. In a memo, Hoover informed Stone that he had begun combing through personnel files and identifying incompetent or crooked agents who should be fired. Hoover also told Stone that per his wishes, he had raised the employment qualifications for new agents, requiring them to have some legal training or knowledge of accounting. "Every effort will be made by employees of the Bureau to strengthen the morale," Hoover wrote, "and to carry out to the letter your policies." In December 1924, Stone gave Hoover the job he longed for. Hoover would rapidly reshape the Bureau into a monolithic force. One that, during his nearly five-decade reign as director, he would deploy not only to combat crime, but also to commit egregious abuses of power. Hoover had already assigned White to investigate one of the first law enforcement corruption cases to be pursued in the wake of Teapot Dome. White took over as the warden of the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, where he led an undercover operation to catch officials who, in exchange for bribes, were granting prisoners nicer living conditions and early releases. One day during the investigation, White came across guards pummeling a pair of prisoners. White threatened to fire the guards if they ever abused an inmate again. Afterward, one of the prisoners asked to see White privately. As if to express his gratitude, the prisoner showed White a Bible, then began to lightly rub a mixture of iodine and water over its blank fly page. Words magically began to appear. Written in invisible ink, they revealed the address where a bank robber, who had escaped before White became warden, was hiding out. The secret message helped lead to the bank robber's capture. Other prisoners, meanwhile, began to share information, allowing White to uncover what was described as a system of gilded favoritism and millionaire immunity. White gathered enough evidence to convict the former warden, who became prisoner number 24207 in the same penitentiary. A bureau official who visited the prison wrote in a report, "I was very much struck with the feeling among the inmates relative to the action and conduct of Tom White. There seems to be a general feeling of satisfaction and confidence, a feeling that they are now going to get a square deal." After the investigation, Hoover sent a letter of commendation to White that said, "You brought credit and distinction not only to yourself but to the service we all have at heart." White now arrived at headquarters, which was then situated on two leased floors in a building on the corner of K Street and Vermont Avenue. Hoover had been purging many of the frontier lawmen from the bureau, and as White headed to Hoover's office, he could see the new breed of agents, the college boys who typed faster than they shot. Old-timers mocked them as Boy Scouts, who had college-trained flat feet. And this was not untrue, as one agent later admitted, "We were a bunch of greenhorns who had no idea what we were doing." White was led into Hoover's immaculate office, where there was an imposing wooden desk and a map on the wall showing the locations of the Bureau's field offices. And there, before White, was the boss man himself. Hoover was then remarkably slim and boyish-looking. In a photograph taken of him several months earlier, he is wearing a stylish dark suit. His hair is thick and wavy, his jaws held tight, and his lips are pressed together sternly. His brown eyes have a watchful gaze, as if he were the one looking through a camera. White and his cowboy hat loomed over the diminutive Hoover, who was so sensitive about his modest stature that he rarely promoted taller agents to headquarters and later installed a raised dais behind his desk to stand on. If Hoover was intimidated by the sight of this monstrous Texan, he didn't show it. He told White that he needed to discuss a matter of the utmost urgency with him. It had to do with the murders of the Osage. White knew that the sensational case was one of the Bureau's first major homicide investigations, but he was unfamiliar with its details, and he listened as Hoover spoke in staccato bursts, a strategy that Hoover had devised in his youth to overcome a bad stutter. In the spring of 1923, after the Osage Tribal Council had passed the resolution seeking the Justice Department's help, the then-Director Burns had dispatched an agent from the Bureau to investigate the murders, which by then totaled at least 24 Osage. The agent spent a few weeks in Osage County before concluding that any continued investigation is useless. Other agents were subsequently dispatched to investigate, all to no avail. The Osage had been forced to finance part of the federal investigation with their own money, an amount that would eventually reach $20,000, the equivalent today of nearly $300,000. Despite this expenditure, Hoover had decided, after assuming command of the Bureau, to dump the case back on state authorities in order to evade responsibility for the failure. The FBI agent who was in charge of the Oklahoma field office had assured Hoover that the transfer could be handled without any unfavorable comment in the press. Yet that was before the Bureau, Hoover's Bureau, had blood on its hands. A few months earlier, agents had persuaded the new governor of Oklahoma to release the outlaw Blackie Thompson, who'd been captured and convicted of bank robbery, so that he could work undercover for the Bureau to gather evidence on the Osage killings. In field reports, the agents noted excitedly that their undercover man had begun to work among the crooks in the oil fields and get the evidence he has promised us. The agents proclaimed, "We expect splendid results." But while the agents were supposed to be keeping Blackie under close surveillance, they'd lost him in the Osage Hills. He then proceeded to rob a bank and kill a police officer. It took months for authorities to apprehend Blackie, and as Hoover noted, a number of officers had to take their lives in their hands to correct this mistake. So far, Hoover had managed to keep the Bureau's role in the affair out of the press, but behind the scenes there was a growing political uproar. The state attorney general had sent Hoover a telegram indicating that he held the bureau responsible for failure of the investigation. John Palmer, the tribe's well-known advocate, sent an angry letter to Charles Curtis, the Kansas senator, insinuating that the bureau's investigation had been tainted by corruption. I join in the general belief that the murderers have been shrewd enough and politically and financially able enough to have honest and capable officers removed or sent to other parts, and also to quiet dishonest officials whose duty it was and is to hunt the perpetrators of these awful crimes. Comstock, the Oklahoma lawyer who had served as the guardian to several Osage, had personally briefed Senator Curtis on the Bureau's catastrophic bungling. When Hoover met with White, his grip on power remained tenuous, and he was suddenly confronting the one thing that he'd done everything to avoid since becoming director, a scandal. The situation in Oklahoma, Hoover believed, was acute and delicate. Even a whiff of misconduct coming so soon after Teapot Dome could end his career. Only weeks earlier, he'd sent a confidential memo to White and other special agents stating, "This bureau cannot afford to have a public scandal visited upon it." As White listened to Hoover, it became evident why he'd been summoned. Hoover needed White, one of his few experienced agents, one of the cowboys, to resolve the case of the Osage murders and thereby protect Hoover's job. "I want you," Hoover said, "to direct the investigation." He ordered White to set out for Oklahoma City and assume command of the field office there. Later, Hoover pointed out to White that because of the region's lawlessness, the field office is probably turning out more work than any other office in the country and consequently has to have in charge of it a thoroughly competent and experienced investigator and one who can handle men. White knew that relocating to Oklahoma would be a great burden to his family, but he understood the stakes of the mission and he told Hoover, "I am human enough and ambitious enough to want it." White had no doubt what would happen if he didn't succeed. Previous agents on the case had been banished to distant outposts or cast out from the bureau entirely. Hoover had said, "There can be no excuse offered for failure." White was also aware that several of those who had tried to catch the killers had themselves been killed. From the moment he walked out of Hoover's office, he was a marked man. 9. The Undercover Cowboys. After taking over the Oklahoma City field office in July 1925, White reviewed the Bureau's voluminous files on the Osage murders, which had been amassed over the previous 2 years. Murder cases that are not solved quickly are often never solved. Evidence dries up, memories fade. More than 4 years had elapsed since the killings of Anna Brown and Charles Whitehorn, and frequently the only way to crack such cases is to find an overlooked clue submerged within the original cache of records. The files on the murders of the Osage contained history in its rawest form. Bits of data vacuumed up without any chronology or narrative, like a novel whose pages were out of order. White scoured this randomness for a hidden design. Though he was accustomed on the frontier to dealing with violent death, the brutality detailed in the reports was breathtaking. An agent wrote of the bombing of the Smith's house, "The two women perished instantly, their bodies being blown asunder, and pieces of their flesh being later found plastered on a house 300 feet away." Previous agents had concentrated on the 6 cases that seemed most likely to be solved. The bombing deaths of Rita Smith and her husband Bill Smith and their servant Nettie Brookshire, and the fatal shootings of Anna Brown, Henry Rowan, and Charles Whitehorn. White struggled to find links among all the 24 murders, but a few things were evident. Rich Osage Indians were being targeted, and 3 of the victims, Anna Brown, Rita Smith, and their mother Lizzie, were blood-related. Surprisingly, agents hadn't spoken to Lizzie's surviving daughter, Molly Burkhart. Investigators were taught to see the world through the eyes of others. But how could White fathom what this woman had seen? From being born in a lodge on the wild prairie, to being catapulted into a fortune, to being terrorized as her family and other Osage were picked off one by one. The files offered few insights about Molly's life. mentioning only that she was ill with diabetes and had secluded herself in her house. A few details in the files seemed telling. Repeat killers tend to rigidly adhere to a routine, yet the Osage murders were carried out in a bewildering array of methods. There was no signature. This, along with the fact that bodies turned up in different parts of the state and country, suggested that this was not the work of a single killer. Instead, whoever was behind the crimes must have employed henchmen. The nature of the murders also gave some insight into the mastermind. The person was not an impulsive killer, but a connoisseur of plots who was intelligent enough to understand toxic substances and calculating enough to carry out his diabolical vision over years. As White scrutinized the data and reports, one plausible storyline after another seemed to cohere, but upon close inspection, the information invariably traced back to the same dubious sources— private eyes and local lawmen whose opinions were based on little more than hearsay. Given that corruption seemed to permeate every institution in Osage County, these sources might be intentionally spreading disinformation in order to conceal the real plot. White realized that the greatest problem with the earlier investigations was not that agents had failed to uncover any leads, it was that there were too many. Agents would develop one and simply drop it or fail to corroborate it or to conclusively disprove it. Even when agents seemed to be moving on the right track, they had not managed to produce any evidence that would be admissible in a court of law. As White strove to be a modern evidence man, he had to learn many new techniques, but the most useful one was timeless. Coldly, methodically separating hearsay from facts that he could prove. He didn't want to hang a man simply because he had constructed a seductive tale. And after years of bumbling, potentially crooked investigations into the Osage murders, White needed to weed out half-facts and build an indubitable narrative based on what he called an unbroken chain of evidence. White preferred to investigate his cases alone, but given the number of murders and leads to follow, he realized that he would need to assemble a team. Yet even a team wouldn't overcome one of the main obstacles that had stymied previous investigators, the refusal of witnesses to cooperate because of prejudice, corruption, or, as an agent put it, an almost universal fear of being bumped off. So White decided that he would be the public face of the investigation, while most of the agents operated undercover. Hoover promised him, "I'll assign as many men as you need." Recognizing the limits of his college boys, Hoover had kept on the rolls a handful of other cowboys, including White's brother Doc. These agents were still learning scientific sleuthing, still adjusting to completing their reports on a typewriter. But White decided that these men were the only candidates who could handle such an assignment. Infiltrating wild country, dealing with outlawry, shadowing suspects, going days without sleep, maintaining cover under duress and handling deadly weapons if necessary. White began putting together a squad of cowboys, but he didn't include Doc. Since serving in the Rangers, he and his brother had avoided being assigned to the same cases in order to protect their family from potentially losing two members at once. White first recruited a former New Mexico sheriff who at 56 became the oldest member of the team. Though reserved to the point of being shy, the sheriff was adept at assuming undercover identities, having pretended to be everything from a cow rustler to a counterfeiter. White then enlisted a stocky, garrulous, and blond-haired former Texas Ranger who, according to a superior, was best suited for situations where there is any element of danger. In addition, White brought on an experienced deep-cover operative who looked more like an insurance salesman, perhaps because it was his former profession. One agent from the previous investigation, White decided, should be retained, John Berger. He had a comprehensive knowledge of the case, from the suspects to the trails of evidence, and he had developed an extensive network of informants that included many outlaws. Because Berger was already well known in Osage County, he would work openly with White. So would another agent, Frank Smith, a Texan who listed his interests thus: pistol and rifle practice, big game hunting, game fishing, mountain climbing, adventures, man hunting. In Hoover's bureau, Smith was classified as one of the older type of uneducated agents. Finally, White brought in the singular John Wren. A one-time spy for the revolutionary leaders in Mexico, Wren was a rarity in the bureau, an American Indian. Quite possibly he was the only one. Wren was part Ute, a tribe that had flourished in what is today Colorado and Utah, and he had a twirled mustache and black eyes. He was a gifted investigator, but he'd recently washed out of the bureau for failing to file reports and meet regulations. A special agent in charge had said of him with exasperation, "He is exceedingly skilled in handling cases, and some of his work can only be described as brilliant. But of what avail are many nights and days of hard application to duty if the results are not embodied in written reports? He has all the information in his head, but will not commit it to paper." In March 1925, Hoover had reinstated Wren, but only after warning him, "Unless you measure up to the standards that are now in effect in this bureau, I will be compelled to request your resignation." White knew that Wren would bring an essential perspective to the team. Some of the previous agents on the case, including Berger, had betrayed the kind of casual prejudice toward the Osage that was in commonplace. In a joint report, Berger and another agent had stated, "The Indians in general are lazy, pathetic, cowardly, dissipated." And Berger's colleague insisted that the only way to make any of these dissolute, stubborn Osage Indians talk and tell what they know is to cut off their allowance, and if necessary, throw them in jail. Such contempt had deepened the Osage's distrust of the federal agents and hindered the investigation. But Wren, who referred to himself as one of Hoover's braves, had capably handled many delicate cases on reservations. White relayed to Hoover which men he wanted, and those not already assigned to the Oklahoma office received urgent orders in code from headquarters, "Proceed undercover immediately, reporting to agent in charge, Tom White." Once the team had been assembled, White grabbed his gun and set out for Osage County, another traveler in the mist. 10. Eliminating the Impossible. One after the other, the strangers slipped into Osage County. The former sheriff showed up in the guise of an elderly, quiet cattleman from Texas. Then the talkative former Texas Ranger appeared, also presenting himself as a rancher. Not long afterward, the one-time insurance salesman opened a business in downtown Fairfax, peddling bona fide policies. Finally, Agent Wren arrived as an Indian medicine man who claimed to be searching for his relatives. White had counseled his men to keep their covers simple so they didn't betray themselves. The two operatives acting as cattlemen soon ingratiated themselves with William Hale, who considered them fellow Texas cowboys and who introduced them to many of the leading townsfolk. The insurance salesman dropped by the houses of various suspects under the pretense of hawking policies. Agent Wren made his own inroads attending tribal gatherings and gleaning information from Osage who might not otherwise talk to a white lawman. Wren had lived among the Indians and had gotten away with it in remarkable shape, White told Hoover, adding that his undercover men seemed to be able to withstand the rigor of the life. It was hard for White to know where to begin the investigation. The records from the coroner's inquest into the death of Anna Brown had mysteriously vanished. "My desk was broken into and the testimony disappeared," the justice of the peace in Fairfax said. Virtually no evidence had been preserved from the various crime scenes, but in the case of Anna, the undertaker had secretly kept one object, her skull. About the size of a melon, the hollow chamber felt unnervingly light in one's hand, air blowing through as though it were a sun-bleached shell. White examined the skull and could see the hole in the back where the bullet had entered. He concluded, as earlier investigators had, that the bullet must have come from a small-caliber gun, a .32 or perhaps a .38 pistol. He, too, noticed the oddity that there was no exit wound in the front of Anna's skull, which meant that the bullet had lodged inside her head. The bullet would have been impossible to miss during the autopsy. Someone on the scene, a conspirator or even the killer, must have swiped it. The justice of the peace admitted that he had harbored such suspicions as well. He was pressed on the matter. Was it possible that, say, the two doctors, David and James Schoen, had taken it?
I don't know, he said.
When David Schoen was questioned, he conceded that there was no exit wound, but he insisted that he and his brother had made a diligent search for the bullet. James Schoen protested similarly. White was convinced that somebody had altered the crime scene, but given the number of